call now the case in the matter of Judge Emilio Davila. Counsel, please come to the council table.
May it please the court, Mr. Arthur Mitchell and Mr. Tito Davila Jr. will give an argument for the petitioner. Mr. Mitchell will open.
May I announce before you begin that Justice McGee's absence is due to his illness. He's at home. All of these arguments are recorded on cassettes to which he may listen, to which you may listen, and to which the media may have access if they so desire. All right, the argument from petition.
Hey, please report. I'm Arthur Mitchell, Austin, Texas. I believe the court would like to take about 15 minutes of my time, Your Honor, and leave allocate 15 minutes to co-counsel. I'll discuss the jurisdictional point. Co-counsel will take the point four. My point's point three in the brief.
All right, so we understand each other. As petitioner, you'll have 30 minutes total time
to
open.
That's right, Judge.
The 30 minutes, and you have 15 to close.
Right. That's right, Judge. Right. I would like to divide the opening, however, on that basis with leave of court, that I will take the jurisdictional point 15 minutes.
No problem. Your time is run.
Thank you, Judge. This proceeding, as the court is aware, is a petition to reject the recommendation of the commission contained on September 30th of 1981 that Judge Davila be removed from office. I would like to address, first of all, the constitutional point in this case. In order for the court to appreciate the position taken by the petitioner on jurisdiction, I have to go back into the facts somewhat. First of all, at the outset, this procedure has turned out to be one of quite an ordeal for the judge. Beginning in September of last year, the judge was notified by notice of preliminary investigation, actually May 5th of 1980. The judge was notified that there were charges pending against him. Now, without going into great detail as to those charges were broken down essentially in misconduct in the appointment of a son-in-law in certain cases, causing the verbal arrest to be made of a certain Leon Ramirez, and a matter dealing with a collision of a judge in an automobile having left the scene of that collision. The commission convened on August 1st, and on August the 1st, entered the following order. Upon motion made by Justice Colson, seconded by Mr. Godfrey, and unanimously carried, the commission voted to publicly reprimand Judge Davila, August 1st, 1980. Now, at that particular point, Judge Davila's problems commenced. The simple reason that under Rule 3B of the rules governing the commission was obligated at that time to enter a companion order of termination. And I refer to it briefly, if it please the court. This being a Rule 3 investigation or a preliminary investigation or notice, Rule 3 provides, and this now I'm addressing the August 1st action of the commission. If the investigation does not disclose sufficient cause to warrant formal proceedings, the commission may in its discretion issue a private or public reprimand. Well, it chose to issue a public reprimand. But now let's read the balance of the rule carefully. And if it chooses to issue a public reprimand, which it did August 1st, 1980, it must, at that time, enter an order terminating the investigation. In fact, the rule uses the mandatory shall. And, of course, by definition, under the definition section of the rules, shall is the same we all recognize as being mandatory. Now, the rule further provides that if the notice pursuant to Rule 3B has been given to the judge, he shall be notified of that termination. Now, August 1st, public reprimand vote was taken. That vote was taken on a specific notice. Now, I want to comment briefly on the notice. The preliminary notice that's attached to our brief, the notice says you've got to be up here on one of 2 days. Very, very indefinite notice. Provides that you have an opportunity. You're going to have a meeting up here at Austin on August the 1st and 2nd, 1980. The judge's attorney notified the commission. He couldn't be here, but something strikes me as being unfair about the notice. Notwithstanding that fact, the commission had its hearing on August 1st. Now, to compound the error, without further notice, without further to do, on the second day of August, the commission undertook to rescind that August the 1st action. Now, I have looked the rules over, and I cannot find any power in the commission once it takes Rule 3 action to rescind. I'm reading from the minutes. The following day, on August 2nd, now, if it pleases the court, remember, there has been no further notice to the judge. The original notice said August 1st and 2nd. He was not present at this second meeting, and it was a 4-3 vote to rescind the prior vote against of public reprimand, and a formal hearing order was entered. Now, the formal hearing order, notice of formal proceeding, is dated on August the 8th, 1980. I'm sorry, August the 14th. That notice, if it pleases the court, tracks essentially the original Rule 3 notice. Appointment of son-in-law, order of arrest of Leon Ramirez, accident in the automobile. Now, following that formal notice of hearing on Rule 4, master was appointed. Hearing was held from October 20th, 1980 to October 23rd, 1980 before the master. Did a tremendous job. Returned findings of fact, conclusion of law. Now, here we go. We've already had an August 1st public reprimand. We have a rescission August the 2nd. We have a failure of the commission to terminate on that August 1st. We have a failure of the commission to issue and say, now, Judge Davila, we've reprimanded you. Here's an order of reprimand. Here's a notice of termination, and we're shutting her down. You have acted improperly, and that's it. The commission rescinds this order, has a full-blown hearing, and on September 4th issues another order. The order of censure on May the 4th was based on the notice of final hearing, that notice that was generated out of that August 2nd hearing, if it pleases the court. He was censured, and then an astounding thing occurs. The very same day, that is May 4th, 1980, the commission issues a public reprimand. Now, as this court has noted in Carrillo, Bates, Brown, the commission got the power to dismiss, censor, reprimand, or make a recommendation. But it's got to act on some character of notice, if it pleases the court. There was no notice of that public reprimand order entered May 4th, 1980. The public reprimand order, if it pleases the court, was wide. Pardon me, Judge. I meant May 4th, 1980. Yes, Judge.
We were up in
80 or 81.
81. I'm sorry, Judge. Yes.
You had me confused.
81. May 4th, 81. Make a change. We've moved from August of 80, August 2nd to 80 for the following year, Judge Benton. I'm sorry, I misled the court. Now we're talking about 81. We have, in other words, the action of the commission moved to 4. They enter a final judgment. The matter should be closed. However, there's a final shot. Parting shot was dated May 4th, 1981, which is the public reprimand. The commission's attorney, in brief filed before that body, admits that there was no notice for that hearing, no opportunity to be present in compliance with the due process mandate of the Constitution governs these proceedings. But nevertheless, the order of public reprimand received wide publicity. We say that order was void. Void for several reasons. First of all, the commission had no authority after the August 1st public reprimand. And number two, it had no authority. The simple reason it didn't follow its own rules. Notwithstanding, matter should have been put to rest. Then we have, continuing in this very same case, July 21st, a second notice of formal proceeding. Now, it is, this is not the character of case where you have some outstanding conduct that has arisen in the interim and the court and the commission invokes its jurisdiction under 304. And that second notice of formal hearing, it's recited it. And I'm not going to go into full detail, but if I, my recollection serves me correctly, it recites that it opens, that this second notice of formal hearing opens numbered cause be reopened for further consideration. Now, a second time, we don't have an end of the process. Of course, you know, we're dealing now with an elected official. We're dealing with an officer who has the public has put in his office. And I'm not going to go into the beautiful language of this court in Laughlin on staying out of political problems, on treating the burdens lightly that we have here to discharge. But there was no notice of termination on May 4th, 1981. Now, there was no action on the July 21st, 1981 notice, but the notice was amended, and what is characterized as an amended second notice of formal proceedings. That's August 7th, 1981. Now, taking those paragraphs out of the preliminary one, going way back there, May 5th, 1981, coming forward, right on down the line, I've taken those paragraphs. Paragraph 1 of the amended second notice is the same as the second paragraph in the original. Paragraph 2 is the same. There is an addition here of the alleged act of misconduct in having appointed a son-in-law by the name of Nieto in 1979. In 1979. It is upon the basis of this second amended, the wording is awkward, amended second notice of formal procedure that the present recommendation to remove arises. Now, there's no doubt that the commission has the power to amend as it goes along. Carrillo points that out. But the question is, what's the difference between Carrillo and this case? Of course, under Rule 11, as the court quotes in Carrillo, if the commission is in an ongoing investigation, it can amend. Rule 11 of the rules provides specifically that you can amend the charge to comport with evidence. But that's not what we have here. If that rule is carefully read, the rule says prior to determination. That's the key rule in Rule 11. Now, we say this, that the commission cannot censor, cannot reprimand, and at the same time refer to this court and recommend to remove. Now, that's strong language, but the source of that position in this brief is the following provisions of the Constitution. As this court knows, without the provision of the Constitution, you can't remove a public official. Now, Article 5, Section 1A, Section 6 provides the power in which the rules were enacted to institute these character proceedings. It states specifically that a judge may be removed from office for willful, persistent conduct, and that's the definition carried over in the rules. He may be removed from office for willful and persistent conduct, or any person holding such office may be censured in lieu of removal. That's the first intimation. You can't do them both. Coming on down, the same constitutional provision, Section 8. If after formal hearing, this is the tail end section, final sentence that places the court of Section 8. If after formal hearing or after considering the record and report of the master, which was done here, the commission finds good cause, therefore, it shall issue an order of public censure, which it did. Then the rule continues, the Constitution is continued. Or, now you understand, this is what the commission did twice here. It did it August 1st of 1980, and it did it May 4th, 1981. And then it chose to make reference to recommend. That's not what the Constitution says. That's not the rule. Rule provides, and I'm going to read, or it shall recommend to the Supreme Court the removal or retirement. It's disjunctive. That same concept, that is, you censor, you reprimand, you suspend. Now, the commission had the power to do that at the outset in this case, no question about it. Or it had the power to just say, look, let's adduce the facts and let the Supreme Court do it, such as the Creel case. But it can't do them both. It can't censure him, can't reprimand him, and then can't reprimand on essentially the same record removal. Now, Rule 17 of the rule carries that concept forward. Looking at Rule 17 briefly. Rule 17 provides, if it pleases the court, that if after hearing the evidence, the commission finds good cause by affirmative vote, it shall recommend to the Supreme Court the removal, retirement, censure, or suspension. It can do that at the outset. And these alternatives, of course, the court notes in prior opinions, such as Carrillo, such as the Bates case, those cases. But now the rule provides further. It shall recommend to the Supreme Court the removal, retirement, censure. Or, the rule says, and I'm quoting, or in the alternative, not conjunctively, or in the alternatively, the commission may order a private reprimand, order a public censure, both of which it did here, August 1st, 1980, and May 4th, 1981, or suspension of the judge. There is no provision to enhance as is sought to be done in this case. He's been reprimanded. He's been reprimanded twice. He's been censured once, and now they want to come in and recommend a removal. We say there's no power under Article 5, 1A, 6, and 8, and the rules. Thank you.
Further argument from petitioner?
Commissioner of the Court, Your Honor. My name is Emilio Davila, Jr., an attorney from Laredo, Texas. Gentlemen, you have before you here today a 58-year-old judge sitting here in the audience, prior unblemished record, never been up for any disciplinary action before. No criminal charges pending against him whatsoever, unlike all of the judges that have been removed in the cases that have been decided by this court. And I cite Laughlin, I cite Carrillo, and Bates. All of those, there were criminal charges that had already been brought, indictments pending. That is not the case with Judge Davila here, as it was not the case with Judge Brown, wherein this court rejected the recommendation for removal made by the commission. With that, gentlemen, I would like to point out that there are constitutional rights of which the judge has been deprived, which are founded in due process, and they are three in nature. Number one, the right to a fair and impartial tribunal. Number two, the right to have the force and effect of res judicata applied to the facts of his case. And number three, the right to have him acquitted and sent home already having been censured because of the insufficiency of the evidence. Now, with that in mind, Mr. Mitchell has already pointed out to the court that there were 26 instances where the judge appointed his son-in-law, Roger Brocha, and a verbal order of arrest. And there were findings made by Judge Hazlett, who was appointed by this court in that matter. And I would like to point out to the court that Judge Hazlett pointed out in his findings of fact, he said, it is up to the commission to decide whether errors of judgment may be entertained for grounds for removal. And he said that in reference to both the 26 appointments of Roger Rocha, and he also said it in reference to the verbal arrest that was ordered by the judge. And I would submit that at the time that Judge Hazlett, Honorable Master, made his findings, that he had not closely read Laughlin at that point in time, because this court has already addressed that issue and has stated that it will not consider errors of judgment as grounds for removal.
Counsel, as I recall, wasn't Laughlin before the constitutional amendment, or was it afterwards?
Laughlin, Your Honor, was in 1974. Yes, sir, it was in 1974. I think it was before the Constitutional Amendment. Yes, sir. Now, additionally, Your Honor, in the Honorable Master also failed to find that there was any willful conduct on the part of Judge Davila, so as to cast public discredit on the judiciary. An essential element of the commission's case. Now, as has been stated by co-counsel, on July of 81, after they did the public censure and reprimand, which vilified the judge in his own electoral unit, they distributed copies of the censure and reprimand, politically assassinated the judge, in Webb County. After that, they come out with this July second notice of formal proceedings, wherein they go in and they grab conduct which occurred prior to May 4th, 1981, and use that as the basis in their second notice of formal proceedings. And they raise their 2 points, the appointment of the master, which he'd already been reprimanded for, and they raise in there the removal of the judge of an independent executrix in a probate estate. Then 2 months later, in August 7th of 1981, they file a second amended notice of formal proceedings raising the same two items, the appointment of the master, the removal of the independent executrix, and the appointment of a son-in-law that happened back in February of 1979, and then additionally charged that the judge committed perjury on May 1st of 1981 before the commission. And I point out, all four of these grounds having occurred prior to, the conduct having occurred prior to May 4th, 1981. And on the item of that the judge committed perjury before the commission, we have covered that diligently in our brief, because I would be the first gentleman to painfully urge that the judge be removed if you find, by clear and convincing evidence, that he did perjure himself before the commission, because that conduct would be absolutely inexcusable. Now, as to his right to a fair and impartial tribunal, it's stated Article 5, Section 1A, Subpart 11 of the Texas Constitution. It's stated in the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, property right. It's been so held by the Fifth Circuit in NLRB versus Phelps, which is in our brief, and they applied it there in reference to an administrative proceeding. And the Fifth Circuit held in that decision that it should be particularly applicable to the necessity of having a fair and impartial tribunal in an administrative proceeding, because there is a tendency to relax the normal safeguards that accompany a court proceeding. And thus, there's all the more necessity for a close scrutiny as to whether there was a fair and impartial tribunal at an administrative agency level. And in support of the want of a fair and impartial tribunal, gentlemen, at page 7 of our reply brief, there are 16 articulated items on the part of the examiner in this case and on the part of the commission in this case, which I will very briefly cover because of short time, but they're on page 7 of our reply brief, and they're throughout our brief that was filed in this case. The extreme personal and political animosity that existed between the judge and Charles Borchers, then making that connection between the close admitted personal relationship that existed between Charles Borchers and the examiner in this case, Max Fluchet, who previously used to live and would have his home frequented by Mr. Charles Borchers, who was the main political protagonist of the judge in Webb County. In addition to that, Mr. Borchers and the examiner both presented evidence before the examiner. They made spurious allegations of perjury over before Honorable Judge Hazlett, who he recognized them as spurious and denied their trial amendment wherein they sought to raise the issue of perjury. And he covers that in the letter that he writes to the commission, the Honorable Master does, which is in the record. There was additionally the fact that the examiner apprises, and he admits so in the brief that he filed with the commission at page 17, that when the judge comes in, he's going to question him in reference to a brand new matter on which the judge has received no notice. He makes that admission on page 17 of his brief that he filed with the commission. Then when the judge gets in there and they make inquiry into this brand new matter, and I as counsel, Mr. Mitchell wasn't in the case yet, I as counsel and representing him make an objection, and my objection is allayed by a statement by the commission that they're going to consider this matter solely for purposes of trying to get some elucidation of the judge's state of mind. With that representation, they allowed the examiner to go ahead and get into the new inquiry, and then subsequently, the basis of that inquiry is what they came back and charged as perjury on May 1st, contrary to the representation that had been made by the commission. In addition to that, the examiner deleted a portion of the statement of facts before the commission. He was requested that he produce that portion, and he said that he would not. In addition to that, the examiner has admittedly made statements to public officials in Webb County, Texas, that he is going to make a recommendation for removal prior to any depositions being taken in Webb County, Texas on August the 19th, gentlemen. In addition to that, the examiner sought during the course of depositions that were taken in Webb County, Texas, on August the 19th of this year, to introduce a materially altered exhibit. And that's in the record. It's on the record at page... It's on the record at pages 17 and 19 in the deposition of Horace Hall, counsel, an attorney in Laredo, Texas. Now, additionally, well, there's about another four or five items that are listed in our brief. And then finally, gentlemen, the judge had made no appointments of his son-in-law whatsoever from May 4th of 1981 on. He's asked by the commission whether he will make any more appointments in the unit, and he tells them that he will not. Now, there was no likelihood that there was going to be any recurrence. There had been no recurrence since May 4th, but yet on September the 30th, even though there was no likelihood of any recurrence, they go ahead and recommend removal to this court, fine, but with a recommendation that he be suspended. What was to be gained? Now, in reference to the applicability of res judicata, I would point the court to its 1979 decisions, Texas Water Commission versus Crow Iron Works, and Delaney versus United Surfaces, which are cited in our brief, wherein the court defines res judicata and what is required for its applicability. We would submit to the court that that definition fits the facts of this case. Additionally, res judicata, gentlemen, is not a technical rule, but it's a rule of fundamental repose. Repose not only for the litigants, but repose for the electorate also. And we would ask that the court apply it in the facts of this case, that the action that was taken by the commission both on August 1st and May 4th of 1981 was so final, gentlemen, that there was no appeal from it. There was no appeal whatsoever. That's how final the action of the commission was on May 4th. And as to whether res judicata applies, if you look at Rule 3C, the termination order that Mr. Mitchell has been talking about, that is the codified version of res judicata. It's in the rules that were promulgated by this court. Now, in reference, gentlemen, to the insufficiency of the evidence in this case, apparently, the evidence was not sufficient to warrant recommendation for removal on May 4th because that was not done by the commission. So the additional items that exist were three. One, the perjury of May 1st. Two, the appointment of son-in-law Nieto. And three, the removal of the independent executrix. In reference to the perjury, I would ask the court that in reference to they look at our brief, which cites the specific pages and lines in reference to that. In reference to the Nieto appointment, we submit that the doctrine of res judicata should apply, even though it had not been specifically raised previously by the commission. The definition of res judicata by this court in its 1979 decisions point out that it is to resolve the issues that were or may have been litigated between the parties at the time. Additionally, it's barred by Rule 3C. If they didn't enter their termination order, we would not be here today before this court, gentlemen. And it was a one-time, isolated appointment wherein he received $200. There's been absolutely no allegation that he didn't perform the services for it because he did, in fact, perform the services. And in reference to the removal of the independent executrix, she has testified under oath at page 56, from page 54 to 63 of her testimony under oath, that she did not, that her case had been pending for 2.5 years, and it didn't create any problem until May 4th, 1981, when the censure and reprimand order came down. Her attorney, who is the brother of Charles Borchers, saw that the judge was vulnerable as a result of the censure and reprimand order, so he filed a complaint with the commission, and that's what reignited this thing all over again. And we would submit that she has testified under oath that she knowingly failed to appear on three separate occasions upon advice of her counsel. She testified that she had knowingly failed to appear at page 56, and she admits knowing that she was removed as independent executrix for noncompliance with an order of the court. So additionally, that case is presently on appeal in the Fourth Court of Civil Appeals in San Antonio. But the commission has come in, and they want this matter resolved, even though it's pending through the appellate process. Now, I would state to the court, gentlemen, that in conclusion, what is being stated by the judge in this case is that there has been foul play in this case. I, gentlemen, as a former state and federal prosecutor myself, expected the commission to, but not foul ones, gentlemen. And I would submit that based on the incidents that have been articulated, the items that have been set forth in our brief, that it would appear to a disinterested observer that there is bias in this case, that there was bias and that he did not receive a hearing before a fair and impartial tribunal, that res judicata should apply in the facts of this case. We aren't asking the highest court go ahead and hamstring the commission so that they may no longer be allowed to function pursuant to the mandates of the Constitution. But we're asking that res judicata be applied under the facts of this case, gentlemen, because there was a very definite order that was entered. They publicized it. The judge felt the full brunt of it in his electoral unit. There's no appeal from it. They took definitive action, and under those circumstances, res judicata should be applied in the facts of this case. And in reference to the allegation of perjury, we've already made our thoughts known on that. And I thank the court.
It's been some time since I looked at this, and I may be in error. Was there toward the bottom of the reprimand or whatever it was, some sort of a statement that the matter will be a continuing one and that this will not be raised to the judicata?
Yes, sir. There was a statement to that effect. We would submit to the court, however.
You may have wanted to save that for rebuttal, but just to open it up.
Yes, sir. In reference to that, we would take the position, Judge, that just because, contrary to the rules that were promulgated by this court, they go ahead and state that, I don't find that that is binding. It would be the equivalent of some court saying, well, we're going to find in this decision that the Fifth Amendment does not apply. The fact that they made the statement, we would submit, is not controlling, Your Honor.
Thank you. The argument from the department.
May it please the court, Mr. Max Cliche, represent argument for respondent.
If it pleases the court, my name is Max P. Cliche, Jr. I'm legal counsel for the State Commission on Judicial Conduct, and I'm here today to respond to the arguments presented by counsel for Judge Davila. First of all, I need not remind this court of what it has already stated in the Brown case, but throughout the briefs and the argument by the judge's counsel, there is reference to enhancing the punishment. And almost touching upon something like double jeopardy. But in Brown, this court said that these proceedings are not criminal in nature. They may have some punitive effect, but the ultimate goal to be sought by bringing these proceedings is to maintain the high quality of the judiciary. And therefore, these proceedings are sui generis. They have no parallel in either civil or criminal practice. And so, for that reason, the commission is duty-bound to continue surveillance of judges whom it has had before it for disciplinary reasons. Now, I need to address one question here, which I don't know how to address, really. And that is that in raising the due process allegations, the judge's counsel have gone outside the record. They have alluded to facts which are not in the record, which cannot be supported in any way. Some of them are blatantly false. And I think that it would be improper for me to make an affidavit to submit to this court to say what I have done in this case. But this court reviews the record de novo. And as the court said in Brown, even if there are evidences of prejudice and bias in the commission proceedings, those matters are resolved by this court in an adjudicative hearing or in an adjudicative process when they review the record. Now, in the judge's brief, he says that I have admitted all of these things because I did not respond under Rule 419 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, in the rules which have been promulgated by this court, it says with relation to the form of the briefs that the form of the brief shall comply with Rules 418 through 422, except insofar as they may be inconsistent with the rules herein. And I submit that when this court is called upon to review a record de novo, that Rule 419 does not apply, because to hold otherwise would mean that the judge could put anything in his brief. He could say that the moon was made of green cheese, and under Rule 419, that would be held to be true unless denied. And I don't think that Rule 419 should be held to be applicable where this court reviews the record de novo. Now, let me say this with regard to the opportunity to be heard. We started these proceedings in May of 1980, and we got a letter from Judge Davila, of course, didn't show up for the hearing. We got a letter from him a few days later in which he said that he had to attend a surprise birthday party, and that's the reason he didn't come before the commission. That letter's in the record. Then on the occasion of the last appearance before the commission on August the 28th of 1981, he stipulated to the record and agreed that the commission could consider all of the allegations based upon the record that we had made. He had the opportunity at that time to testify if he wanted to, but he didn't avail himself of that opportunity. He could have explained the fact that he didn't lie before the commission on May the 1st. He had that opportunity. He didn't take it. He could have explained his appointment of his other son-in-law in violation of the nepotism statute, but he didn't take that opportunity. Now, to get back to Mr. Mitchell's argument about the August 1st, August 2nd meeting, the only thing I can say about that is that the commission, before taking final action on a vote, certainly has the right to change its mind, and that's all it did. On August the 1st, there was a vote to give him a public reprimand, and then on August the 2nd, there was a motion to reconsider. They did reconsider, and they voted to rescind that resolution and to initiate formal proceedings. And I have been able to find no case, either in this jurisdiction or in any other jurisdiction, which holds that the commission does not have the right to change its mind. And that's all it did in that instance.
Was that reprimand published at that time?
No, sir. It was never even written. It was a two-day meeting of the commission, August 1st and 2nd. They took a vote one day, and the next day they voted to rescind that resolution, and so it was never even written.
But as I understand it, there was a later one that was published. That same year.
There was a public censure.
September? September?
No, sir, not. The only public reprimand or censure was issued on May the 4th of 1981.
Counsel, I'd be interested to hear your answer to the argument of opening counsel that a rule requires that upon issuing a reprimand, you shall enter an order terminating the hearing.
Well, now, in issuing the language that the court alludes to in the public reprimand about it not being raised adjudicata, that is in the public reprimand. And at that time that it had a duty to continue surveillance of Judge Davila's conduct.
Could you tell the court what the rule is? Is it statute, the Constitution, or one of our rules? There's been this about it shall enter an order terminating the whatever it is.
Investigation.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of the proceedings, the commission is relying upon the general authorities of other jurisdictions that the issuance of a public censure or the issuance of a public reprimand is not res judicata. That because of the duty of the...
Is there in a rule or statute or constitution a provision that upon issuing a reprimand you shall enter an order terminating the proceedings?
Yes, sir, there is.
All right, now help us with that.
Is that Rule 3B?
Rule 3B, yes, sir. 3C, you're right. You're right.
What we want to know is why wasn't that done in this case?
I suppose that it is because of my reliance upon N. Ray Kelly, which is a Florida case which is cited in my brief, which holds that the issuance of a public reprimand or a public censure is not res judicata as to the matters before the commission. And then because of my reliance upon the general tenor of the cases in this jurisdiction in California and Oregon, which hold that the purpose of the proceedings before the commission are to maintain the quality of the judiciary, and that therefore conduct which is brought to the attention of the commission after the administration of a reprimand or a censure may be considered as part of the whole cloth of the performance of a judge.
Do any of those other states have a similar rule, 3C?
I'm sure that California has the exact same rule. And if I may have just a minute, I'll look at the rules in California. I do not have rules.
Counselor, if you'd care to file a post-submission brief, that would be
on that issue?
Unless you can straighten it out for us now.
Well, I'll have to file a post-submission brief on that, Your Honor. I suppose that brings me to the...
Does the Kelly case say that you could give additional punishment for the same offenses, or does it say that you could consider prior offenses with something else was done? Do you recall?
Well, of course, it says that you can consider the whole course of conduct engaged in by a judge to determine whether or not he is fit to remain a judge.
As I understand the petitioner's position here, the same act has already been reprimanded, for which the same act would now seek removal. And I was asking if the Kelly case was that kind of a case, or whether or not when Judge Kelly, I presume, committed something additional, you could consider that he's been once reprimanded or twice reprimanded and considered a punishment.
That's exactly what happened in the Kelly case, was that he had been reprimanded prior to that time.
And did something else.
And he did something else, and then he was reprimanded again. They didn't remove him from office. But the language of the Kelly case demonstrates what the function of this commission and of this court is and should be. Let me say one thing, Judge, about the failure to comply with Rule 3C in the administration of the written reprimand and the public censure. In two cases cited in my brief in California, one case in California and one case in Oregon, the California Supreme Court held that the failure of the judge to object to any of the pre-trial proceedings at the time he was before the commission constitutes a waiver of any of those matters which happened prior to the time that the case was submitted to the Supreme Court. Now, in one of those cases, in the Oregon case, two members of the commission had made public statements that were condemnatory of the judge who was under scrutiny. In other words, they had prejudged the case, and they sat as members of the commission which recommended to the Oregon Supreme Court that this judge be removed from office. The Oregon Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court in a similar decision said that the failure to bring that objection up before the commission constituted a waiver. And I think that all of the matters which are complained of that transpired prior to August the 28th of 1981 have been waived by this judge, except for his contention that the issuance of the censure is res judicata and that the issuance of the reprimand is res judicata. The court will recall that the rules in the that have been promulgated by the Supreme Court of California are almost identical with the rules that have been promulgated by this court. In the California case, they cite Rule 911, which is word for word precisely the same as our Rule 11 promulgated by this court. And so I think that there is an absolute waiver of any contention that he may have had of any procedural defects that may have occurred prior to August 28th of 1981.
Does it disturb you that there are some criminal, there's no crime involved, but in a criminal matter, the defendant doesn't have to say anything. And he doesn't waive anything, as I understand it. And your position is if you make charges, he's got to take the stand and check and testify.
Well, of course, it's not a criminal proceeding. It's not even analogous to a criminal proceeding. It's analogous to, if anything, a civil case.
You're taking the position that race judicata is an affirmative defense that has to be pleaded?
No, sir, I'm taking the position that race judicata does not apply to these proceedings because of the nature of the function of this commission and the function of this court.
The specialized type of proceeding. Well, does it concern you that the nepotism, the 26 nepotism charges were raised as early as 1980, following which there was a reprimand, and they're still alive?
How do you mean that they're still alive?
Well, is that part of what he's charged with in these proceedings?
Yes, sir.
And the reprimand previously in no way touched that?
The public censure described the conduct of nepotism in those 26 instances.
I understood that Judge Dalvin did not appeal from the public censure.
No.
It occurred to you that in fairness, he might have said, all right, we have these charges, and I've been reprimanded, and I won't appeal. And then they come along and double-dip him a little later with the same charges. And he had to elect to appeal or not the first time on the public reprimand. Did he have an appeal?
There is no provision for an appeal from the issuance of an order of censure. I suppose that the only remedy that he would have under those circumstances would be to come to this court and ask for a writ of mandamus to command the commission to set aside its order of censure. And that remedy has been described in commissions of other jurisdictions. It has been particularly described in federal cases where federal intervention is sought and the federal courts abstain on the grounds that the judge did not exhaust his state remedies by going to the highest court of the state to seek a writ of mandamus. And so I suppose that remedy would be available to him.
How many times would you be able to publicly reprimand or censure him for the 26th alleged act of nepotism?
Well, of course, the position that the commission takes is that the 26 acts of nepotism, the hit-and-run accident, coupled with all of the four new allegations, that they describe a pattern of conduct which shows that he should not be a judge.
And did the commission know about all these things? And I'm asking, I don't really know. Did the commission know about all these things when they publicly recommended?
No, sir, they did not.
They did not know about them all?
They did not know about the four. Well, they knew about the appointment of his son-in-law as a master in chancery, but they did not know about the appointment of his other son-in-law to be a special commissioner. They did not know at that time that he had lied when he testified before the commission. And they did not know, let's see, what's the fourth one here?
The leaving the scene of the accident.
Well, they knew about that one. Oh, they did not know about his handling of the Montemayor estate, where he, as a matter of fact, that the knowledge of the Montemayor estate is the thing that triggered the commission's interest in reopening the case.
All of the acts for which removal is recommended occurred prior to the censure, but if you're saying that the commission did not know about some of them and decided to change its mind and reopen it and recommend removal as they found about it,
that's correct, Your Honor.
Well, is the reason for Rule 3C and termination of the proceedings, is that because he does not have the right of appeal? And that's why you have to terminate it once you reprimand it?
I cannot answer that question, Your Honor, because I don't know what the reason for the promulgation of that rule was. How much time do I have left, Your Honor? Do you?
I don't know.
Oh. Well, I can see from the questions that have been propounded here that these proceedings are analogized to criminal proceedings, and that the administration of the reprimand and the censure is viewed as punishment, and that the reopening of the case is viewed as punishment.
Counsel, I can speak only for myself. The questions from the bench are seeking information and not prejudgment. I assure you of that. It's not that. It's truly a search of what the ground rules are in this particular case. We don't have that many of these cases.
Well, I was just fixing to say that in the matter of Perry, which is a New Jersey case that's cited in my brief, the judge had ordered the arrest of a street coffee vendor who had sold him a cup of coffee that did not meet with his approval. And he had him handcuffed and brought before him, whereupon he excoriated him. And the Judge Perry was brought before the Commission on Judicial Conduct up there in New Jersey, and he lied to the commission about how he had treated the coffee vendor. And the Supreme Court of New Jersey said that the matter of excoriating the coffee vendor was a minor matter, but that lying to the commission was a matter which could not be condoned, and so they removed him from office for that.
One thing that bothers me about this situation, as I understand, we're supposed to sit as a fact-finding group or a quasi-fact-finding, and we've heard all this talk about perjury here, and not one word said about how the perjury was committed or what else. Who determined that he committed perjury?
Well, the commission found as a fact, and it finds the fact that he lied when he appeared before the commission on May the 1st of 1981.
Well, could you give us some information?
I'll do it. When he was before the commission on May the 1st of 1981, he was questioned about the appointment of his son-in-law to be a master in chancery in a divorce case.
Is this the son-in-law who was appointed 26?
Yes, it's the same son-in-law.
Okay.
Now, the facts of record in that case are that the lawyers in the divorce case had agreed upon the appointment of a master in chancery, an altogether different person, a man by the name of Honore Legardi. When Judge Davila was questioned about that, he said the name of Honore Legardi was merely suggested to me, that the order was not presented to me. There's deposition evidence in the record from two lawyers, Manuel Flores and Horace Hall, and Julio Garcia, three lawyers, who testified that there was a written order with the name of Honore Legardi in it that was presented to Judge Davila, and he rejected it and told them to go back and prepare another order, leaving the name in blank, that is, the name of the master in chancery in blank, and that was done. And then he inserted the name of his son-in-law, Roger Rocha, to be the master in chancery in that. And I'll read you the context in which that testimony was given.
did put out the brief, didn't he?
I can't find it in my brief here.
That's all right. I'll back up all your time. It's in the brief somewhere else. We'll find it.
On page 60 of the statement of facts before the commission on May the 1st of 1981, I asked him, was there another proposed order presented to you with the name of another attorney on it as a proposed master in chancery? His answer, I don't recall at this point in time, but it may have been. Isn't it a fact that another order was prepared to you proposing, and both counsel agreed that Honoré Legardi would be appointed as Master in Chancery? His response was, the order was not presented to me. The name was suggested to me, told that they wanted Honoré Legardi. The deposition evidence of the two lawyers, Hall and Flores, will demonstrate that that statement was absolutely false. There is other testimony by the judge before the commission on May the 1st, 1981, that the amount of the fee that he paid his son-in-law, $6,000, that the amount of the fee was agreed upon by the lawyers. The testimony of Mr. Hall and Mr. Flores is that that amount was considered to be an interim fee, that they thought that the proceedings were going on and that there would be additional duties performed by the master in chancery, that they did not consider the $6,000 to be compensation for services already performed. The services that had been performed by the Master in Chancery had only taken up about 2 or 2.5 days. These two lawyers both considered that the $6,000 fee was excessive. Mr. Flores had even prepared a motion to present to the court to get part of the fee back. The son-in-law, according to Mr. Flores, had promised to give a part of the fee back, but he had not at the time we took the depositions in August 1981. I might say this one thing about the lengthy process that this has been going on, and that is, and I'll make this very brief, Mr. Flores testified that he was one of the character witnesses for Judge Davila at the time that he had his hearing in October of 1980 in Laredo. He said that he would not now testify for him because of his fear that Judge Davila would favor his son-in-law. That evidence was not available to the commission until 1981, and that's the reason for the continuation of this long case.
Counsel, here rebuttal arguments on the petition.
Chief Judge, you had asked a question about the statement in the reprimand and censure orders of res judicata, and we had stated to the court that we thought that their statements of it would not be controlling. But in addition to that, I'd like to point out, Judge, that those same censure and reprimand orders stated in there that they forewarned the judge of any, and I quote, future derelictions, and they forewarned the judge, and I quote, of any future acts of indiscretion. So that they stated that there would be a continuing supervision, but they specified that it would be as to future acts of misconduct by the judge. Additionally, the contention the statement in there that res judicata would not apply, we would submit to the court, would belie the rule that was promulgated by this court, which is 3C, which says the termination order shall be entered, regardless of what their censure or reprimand orders may read in the body. Now, in reference to Mr. Fouché's argument that res judicata should, he stated to the court that double jeopardy should not apply because these proceedings are not criminal in nature, He then said that res judicata should not apply because they are not civil in nature, that they are a hybrid animal. And we would submit to the court that if you unflesh that, then you're seeking to suspend totally this fundamental rule. You're saying it's not civil, so res judicata doesn't apply, and it's not criminal, so double jeopardy doesn't apply. So you're going to totally suspend any concept of fundamental repose, like I've mentioned, not just to the litigant, but to the electorate who placed him in office.
That's why we have rules for the field.
And additionally, Mr. Fouché states that he thought that it would not apply because he relied on the Kelly case. Number one, gentlemen, the Kelly case is not out of California, it's out of Florida. And in our brief, that we filed with the commission, which is part of the record, we meticulously went through the constitutional enabling statute which created the Florida Judicial Qualifications Commission, which is what gives rise to the whole thing, just like the Section 8 and 6 of Article 5, Section 1A of the Texas Constitution gives rise to the commission here. And in there, the Florida Judicial Qualifications Commission, under no circumstances, gentlemen, can do anything but make recommendations to the Florida Supreme Court. Whether it's censure, if they want to censure, they only recommend. If they want to reprimand, they only recommend. It's all heard by the Florida Supreme Court. Whereas in the case here, the commission is empowered under the Constitution to act forcefully and finally in reference to censures and reprimands from which there is no appeal. It's only when they seek to remove that they make a recommendation to their Supreme Court. So we would submit that Kelly, reliance on it is totally misplaced, because the enabling statute that created the Florida Judicial Qualifications Commission is totally different than the enabling statute which creates the commission here in Texas.
Counsel, let me share my concern, and I'll put it in the form of a hypothetical. And again, I'm just looking for information. How are we going to function? What is intended by the constitutional amendment for this judicial? Assume a judge and Judge X from West Texas commits an act of indiscretion. He gets a public reprimand all throughout his election, widely disseminated. He's told not to do it again, like he's seen by the commission. A couple of years later, he does the same thing. Because he told you not to do it, he said, gosh, that was just a mistake on my part. They publicly recommended it, reprimand him again. And a couple of years later, he does it a third time. Now, the commission by this time says, I've had enough. You've had enough. We're going to recommend removal. You've done it now three times. Can the commission use the two prior acts for which public reprimand has been issued, for whatever you want to call it, enhancement, or as a basis for the removal that they would recommend to this court?
Your Honor, I would respect...
I'm trying to pose a fundamental question here in some way to get some light.
To not totally hamstring the commission, I would respectfully submit, Judge, that if it is to be considered, and I think it probably should be, it should be very specifically limited by this court for purposes maybe of what the chairman of the commission told me when I made an objection to them going into a new matter. And he said, counsel, we think it's relevant for purposes of establishing the judge's state of mind. So to answer your question, Judge, I would submit if that same judge from West Texas or X says, gee, I just forgot about it, I think that probably then the examiner for the commission should be able to get into it, not for purposes of establishing the fact that he did it again on the charges that are against him now, but for purposes of establishing his state of mind or for purposes of impeachment. When he gets up there and says, I forgot about it. It just doesn't seem reasonable that he forgot when they just nailed him on it.
Well, I shouldn't have thrown that in the hypothetical. Let's just say he did it three times in succession over a period of years, and on the third time the commission, instead of recommending, says we're going to recommend removal. No question of state of mind involved. He just did it three times.
All right. Then under...
Can they use all three or just the last one?
Judge, I think they should be able to use all three, but instead of reprimanding him the third time, I think if they go ahead and reprimand him the third time, and then tell the Texas Supreme Court, now that we've given him the third reprimand, we want you to remove him, I think that they're incorrect, as pointed out by Mr. Mitchell, because the Texas Constitution in Article 8, in Article 5, Section 1A, 6, and Article 5, Section 1A, 8, and Rule 17 all keep in the alternative. So I think if they went ahead and said, well, we're not going to deal with you on the third one, we're recommending removal, then I think that this court should be allowed to consider the two prior instances to establish the judge's state of mind or for impeachment, like I said.
But had they recommended them the third time, they would not be able.
Yes, sir, they would not, because the Constitution speaks in the alternative. It even has different language. When it says or, in another section, I don't know if it's 6 or 8, but in one it says or, you know, reprimand or censure or offense, and then in the other it says in lieu of. So they even give it to you in a different measure, which amounts to the same thing. Now, in reference to this argument of waiver, Judge, number one, we did not know of some of the acts, some of the major acts that occurred until they made their recommendation for removal on September 30th of this year. And that, the only reason we found out, Judge, is because they're required to file the minute entries, the commission's minute entries along with the records. And it was there that we found out that they had taken this action on the rescission back in August 1st. We didn't have access to that. It was then that we found out that they had received ex parte evidence from Charles Borchers, the judge's chief political protagonist, in the absence of the judge, one-sided evidence. We didn't know about that until a minute, so I submit it would be unreasonable to tell the judge, we're not going to, you waived it when he didn't know about it until after the recommendation was made, the major event, number one. Number two, I would submit, Judge, that it's a fundamental error when you don't have application of some doctrine of final repose. And I would submit that this court has in the past recognized that when you have an error that is fundamental in nature like that, such as double jeopardy or res judicata, the court on its own motion, even if it had never been raised, which in this case it was, it could still consider it. And it also seems to undercut and go contrary to this court's unique function in this case as the ultimate trier of fact, to say, well, we're the ultimate trier of fact, which is basically the same argument Mr. Boucher was making. You're the ultimate trier of fact, you're going to hear all the evidence, but yet something that happened down there has been waived. It seems contrary to the role, the unique role, that is set forth in this court, because you're not, as I understand it, you're not functioning in an appellate capacity, but you're functioning, as you stated in Brown and in Rothman, to make an independent assessment of the facts on your own. And thirdly, there was a request for intervention filed with the Federal District Court in Laredo. And the opinion of Judge Kazin is part of the record. And Judge Kazin stated, Judge Davila, I recognize in my findings that there is deep-rooted political animosity between you and Mr. Borchers. However, based on the Younger Doctrine, he said, I should not, except under very rare circumstances, interfere in a pending state proceeding. He said, I have no reason to believe why the state courts cannot entertain your constitutional question. Now, Judge Kazin having stated that, Mr. Boucher now comes to tell this court, gentlemen, he's waiving his constitutional claim, so that the bottom line is that the federal court says we have no reason to believe the state court cannot competently decide it in a pending matter, so go over there and do it. It doesn't get done here, so the bottom line is he never gets constitutional question addressed. So
for those reasons, I would submit that the waiver argument is not applicable to this case. Now, in reference to the perjury, if I can very briefly do that, because apparently the court is concerned about that, there were three things that they said. Well, first of all, it's covered on page 66 of our brief, kind of. But what was stated was this. Number one, Mr. Fouché said in his brand new charge, he said, "Judge, you testified falsely and perjured yourself when you said that an order presented was when you answered whether an order presented to you had the name of Honoré Ligado." Well, he read the reply, and that is at page 59 and 60 of the proceedings before the commission. And number one, the judge admits that an order was presented to him. And he states there, he says, "Mr. Fouché, I really don't recall at this moment," he says, "but I think it was a statement." Then the question is asked again, and what Mr. Fouché seems to focus on is the judge tells him, "I remember them suggesting the name of Honoré Ligado to me." But the distinction Mr. Fouché seems to draw is that the judge states that it was presented to him verbally, when in fact the blank in the proposed order had the name of Honoré Ligado. And I would submit to you, gentlemen, that had it occurred either way, first of all, he admits it, and then he says, "No, Mr. Fouché, it was suggested, the name of Honoré Ligado was suggested to me." Mr. Fouché has taken the position that it was written in the blank. So what would be the materiality or the difference when the judge tells him, "Yes, I believe it did happen, number one," but then he says, "I think it happened, it was verbally suggested instead of in writing." The second point, he states that the judge perjured himself when he said that the attorneys and the parties determined the amount to be paid the master. Well, we submit to the court on that point, it's simply true. If you see the testimony of the now district attorney in Webb County, Texas, Mr. Julio Garcia, he testified at page 11, line 21 of his deposition, and again at page 12, line 7 of his deposition, that is in fact true. That the $6,000 to be paid to the master were determined by the parties. What Mr. Fouché has done, see, you had a $3 million estate when the master was appointed. And there is testimony in the record by the parties that the fees paid the attorneys were $50,000 to $60,000 a piece. So you're dealing with a very large estate. And what Mr. Fouché did is he took the deposition. You had four attorneys, two representing the woman and two representing the wife. I mean, the husband and the wife. And Mr. Fouché took the testimony of one attorney who was representing the husband and one attorney who was representing the wife. And these two said, "Well, we really don't know whether the parties agreed to it or not because it had been done by the other two gentlemen." So we took the even though Mr. Fouché had said he was going to take the deposition of all four, after he got the deposition of one on each side, he said, "My notice," he says, "disregarded. I don't want to depose the others." And I said, "Well, we do." So we deposed the attorney that was missing over here, and he testified clearly that the parties had agreed. And the signatures of the parties, gentlemen, is on the agreed order before it was submitted to the judge for his signature. Now, in reference to this, well, I see my time is up.
Finish your sentence, counsel.
Thank you. In reference to this semantical, rigid view that is being taken by Mr. Fouché, and that the judge perjured himself, which was not accepted when he tried it before Judge Hazlett, we would submit that the judge complained about that, and again tried to explain to Mr. Fouché during the proceeding itself that they were placing different connotations on the word, and the judge did that, and I quoted where he said, "Mr. Fouché, what you're doing is attempting to put words in my own mouth." And the judge stated that, Judge Donovan did, on the May 1st proceeding before the commission, which was May 1st of this year, and that's in the statement of fact. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the commission, do you wish to file a post-submission brief?
Yes, sir. On the rule, the applicability and the applicability of Rule 3C are...
On anything you prefer, I understood you to suggest that you might file a post-submission brief, or maybe you were just answering my question. I don't care whether you do or don't.
I was responding to the Chief Justice's question, Your Honor, but I will file a post-submission brief.
All right. You'll be given 1 week.
1 week is fine.
Counsel for respondent will have a brief, 1 week to reply.
Yes.
All right. Case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments for both parties. That concludes the oral submissions for the day, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.